ILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Amy Frickholm, the author of the brand new book out just last month called See Me Naked, Stories of Sexual Exile in American Christianity. So we're going to be talking about spirituality and religious faith today, and sexuality. We're talking with Amy by phone from her office in the Christian Century magazine buildings in Chicago. Amy, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Oh, great. We can hear you. Amy is one of the corresponding editors for Christian Century, and I'm sitting here in the studio in Urbana, just surrounded by words from Amy Frickholm. I have her new book, of course, that we're going to talk today, See Me Naked. I have her most recent article in Christian Century, which came out just November 29th, a story about the Nobel Prize winner from Liberia, Lema Gbawi, perhaps her name is pronounced. Over here on my little iPad, I have her words in one of her blogs. And how many blogs do you have? I know you have one with Christian Century, and there's one called Theologue, and then you can also find them at your website, amyfrickholm.com, of course.
Yes, there's really just the Christian Century blog, which used to be called Theologue, and there's my own personal blog. So just those two.
Okay. Well, at any rate, I couldn't be happier being surrounded by your words. You're a wonderful writer, and I'm delighted that you're giving us some time to talk about spirituality and sexuality. And let me spell your last name, since it's a bit unusual. F-R-Y-K-H-O-L-M. And am I saying it right, Frickholm?
That's right, yep.
Good. Amy, I'd like to start off by reading some of your words from your newest book. And I might just tell listeners that we are going to be talking about sexuality today. And her book is quite frank. We won't be using some words, of course, that are in her book on the air, but that will be our topic. So if there are people who might be offended by that, these kind of discussions or children who are listening, you might choose to listen yourself. And then if you think it's appropriate for them to hear later, they can hear it via computer in our archives. But let me start off. You start your book by talking about a fellow Coloradian, and although you're in Chicago right now, you live in a small town, Leadville in Colorado.
Yep.
And you're in the mountains, but you keep up with things happening in Boulder and Denver and Colorado Springs, relatively close by. And of course, Ted Haggard, back in 2009, you start off your book talking about here he is as pastor of this 14,000-member church in Colorado Springs. He's a spiritual counselor to President George Bush. He's president of the National Association of Evangelicals. But he gets suspended from his position in light of the scandal involving a male escort, a masseuse in Denver, sex, drugs, in spite of him seemingly having this perfect family life. You write this. You say, I think, however, I'm also fascinated by Ted Haggard's situation because I recognize his dilemma, specifically his desire to keep his spirituality and his sexuality locked up in different boxes in terror of what would happen if the two were to come together in the public eye. Not only do I recognize this dilemma in myself, but I also saw and heard about it from many of the people that I interviewed for this book. Spirituality and sexuality for many people in America, perhaps especially Christians, are kept rigidly separate, and many struggle to find a way to reconcile the religious elements of their lives and their sexual realities. As you began this book, See Me Naked, Stories of Sexual Exile in American Christianity, and you ended up with these nine stories of fascinating people that you tell in this book. Had you already begun that when the Ted Haggard thing exploded into the media? Or?
That's a good question. Actually, I think I had begun. I'd begun collecting stories because I remember very clearly that the day that the Ted Haggard story broke, you know, and it was big headlines all over Denver, and I was in Boulder at a diner interviewing one of the people who became one of the stories in the book, and we were having our very first conversation there in Boulder, and so I was sitting across from him in the diner looking out the window at newspaper headlines about Ted Haggard. So it was a fascinating juxtaposition. Like, here I am talking about this very subject.
And why did you pick this subject to start with? You acknowledge in this book you have sort of a little bit of a memoir of your own development in terms of spirituality and sexuality woven into these interviews with other folks. But what motivated you to become public, since you just say in the book that you're kind of a shy person?
Yeah, that's a good question. It felt like one of those situations where the subject decided to choose me rather than me choosing the subject. It's hard to answer, but I had returned to Colorado. I spent a year in Ukraine as a Fulbright scholar in American studies. And I had returned to Colorado, and specifically to this small town, and I just started writing. And I didn't really know what I wanted to be writing about. My book about the rapture had come out, and I was, you know, busy talking about that book, but I wanted a new writing project, and I was writing toward something. And the subject that I just kept returning to was religion and sex, religion and sexuality. Who was I as a religious person? Who was I as a sexual person? How did those things come together? And I started to write some essays based on that. And then gradually I realized that I really love to hear and tell stories not just about myself but about other people. And so I started to collect a body of work, just collecting people's stories and then gradually, very gradually, seeing what they might become. It was a very slow process.
Now, this book has been out only a month or so, just a little over a month, but it's already received some great reviews. The Library Journal highly recommended the book, calls it a fascinating, troubling, but finally heartening book. I've read a review in Kirkus Reviews that says it explores the challenges of reconciling pleasure with piety. Could you tell, as you were getting these stories, that they were going to be so fascinating to people?
I probably did about 30, maybe 35 interviews for the book, and so only nine stories ended up. I ended up choosing or selecting nine stories, and I was so moved by so many of the stories that people told me, and as they were telling me, yes, I knew, wow, this is a really important story, and I wonder how I can tell it. And it was a long time to find the form for that story, but I knew almost immediately that it was powerful and important and that somebody had to find a way to talk about it and tell these stories.
Now, you mentioned being a Fulbright scholar. You have a PhD from Duke in literature. You've published academic articles, and one book, I'm guessing, was based on your PhD dissertation in some form or other. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. The book's on the rapture.
And what made you think that there'd be a publisher who would take a popular book on sexuality and spirituality?
I knew I was turning in a more general audience direction by the time I started this book. I knew that I wanted to reach a broader audience with my writing, and that I needed to find that audience in some way. So I had made that turn already, and I was determined to find this audience and this publisher. And it started in relationships with conversations with editors and conversations with an agent, conversations with friends, that gradually helped the form of the book emerge, because that was the part I really couldn't see on my own. What is this going to look like? And that part I developed. But you know, honestly, if you say you're writing a book about religion and sex, people are very interested because those are two difficult and popular subjects. So
popular, but your take on these things and the people you selected and the way you crafted the questions and their responses, I mean, you're dealing with prostitution, you're dealing with sexual addiction, you're dealing with sexual abuse, you're dealing with gay and lesbian issues. And I want to go back to something I mentioned earlier. You were willing to talk about your own sexual development with your spirituality. Were you pushed in that direction by editors, or...
Or did I just go for it?
Yeah, I mean...
Well, it's hard to... that's a great question. I'm not really sure I know the answer. It seemed unfair to keep a really cold distance from the subject.
Uh-huh.
And to pretend that somehow I wasn't implicated in how these stories are told. So it became really important to me that I be as revealing as I could be without... I didn't want it to be about me. I didn't want it to be a memoir. I didn't want it to finally revolve around me and me alone, because I felt like I wanted to share these stories with people, and I wanted to put myself in a position with the reader where they could hear what I was trying to say or what I heard through these stories. So the pieces that I selected for the book about my own sexual development and my own spiritual development were chosen, I hope, to kind of give people a sense of who's talking to them and who the person is who is being the listener and then the teller of these stories. So it was very difficult, and I was advised more than once, you know, I don't know if you should do this. This is really dangerous.
What did your spouse say?
He said it was fine and it was great and he was all for it. So he was very generous. And
how old is your son?
9. He was less excited about the whole prospect. And he still is. He still thinks it's kind of a nightmare. But he's weathering it.
I want to get into talking about some of the specific issues you bring up and the wonderful people you share with your readers. But before I do that, let me remind listeners, this is a live call-in show, Keeping the Faith, every Sunday night here on WILL AM 580. And it's heard also on FM 90.9 HD3, if that gives you better reception on your HD radio. It's also heard online, live, at will.illinois.edu/AM. And if you missed part of this program or would like to share with a friend, you can refer them to the website. It'll be archived in a day or two, or at least in a week, at will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith, and leave the G off of keeping. Keeping, we're very informal, and you can find this to listen to at your convenience. If you'd like to call in and ask Amy Fricholm a question about her book, See Me Naked, published by Beacon Press just this last month, do give us a call. Anywhere in the U.S., continental U.S., you may call us toll-free if it's a long-distance call from Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. And the number is 1-800-222-9455. And if you're in the Champaign-Urbana listening area in Illinois, 217-333-9455 will get you in contact with our studio engineer, Kyle Kroa, and she'll put you in line to talk with our guest, Amy Fricholm. I want to talk, before we leave, the first introduction to your book and talking about the Ted Haggard situation. You mentioned that you were involved in a documentary film that showed on the History Channel by Alexandra Pelosi, and that you were there at the church where Ted Haggard was at the time still pastor, and he was sort of showing off for the cameras and mentioned that Christians have the best sex, and he called two of his male members who were walking by and said, you know, don't you have great sex with your wives? And they said, oh, yes, it's wonderful. And he asked them specifically, well, how often do your wives climax when you make love? And you say you make love every week or several times a week. And both men said, well, they climax every time. Now, if he'd have asked the wives? Would there have been the same response?
Well, I don't know. That's an interesting question. To me, what I really took away from that conversation was that they were acting out a script. So it wasn't so much whether they're telling the truth or they're lying as whether they know the script and they know what they're supposed to say.
Yeah.
And so I really took that as, and I mean, you could look at it as just, oh, they're just hypocrites lying to the camera because it's such an obvious problem that they're posing a kind of reality that I think most people would find unlikely. And they look so uncomfortable posing that reality that it just makes you think, you know, wow, I wonder what the truth is.
Yeah.
That's exactly the kind of story I was trying to avoid because I feel like in American Christianity, we just tell the story of our ideal lives far too often, and we're far less likely to tell these more complicated, more nuanced, more difficult stories of how we've really worked these things out and how painful that can be or how rewarding or, you know, how just complicated.
Well, there are several stories in your book, See Me Naked, that would be wonderful to talk about. And I was telling my spouse this afternoon after rereading your book this week that I'd love to interview for 4 or 5 consecutive weeks, but we just can't do that. But there's some great stories in here. Let's jump to Mark. A pastor's son, he was involved in a parachurch evangelical organization called Young Life. He was a guitar player. He was an athlete. He was attractive. And he was influenced by what you came to see in conversation with him, with sort of the erotic milieu of the Young Life meetings. So talk a little bit about what you discovered about that.
Because it is very difficult to talk about, because once you start to talk about how church often functions as a place where attractions are really important and how you feel about, and often in American Christianity it means how you feel about the person on stage, you know, how you, what
behind,
you project.
Behind the pulpit or behind
exactly,
the guitar.
Exactly. How you project your ideal world onto that person, and especially if they're good looking or they're and in American Christianity, so much of church is based on attraction. So it really helps if they're good looking, because then you can project so much more onto an ideal life that you think that person leads. This is also true in the Ted Haggard situation, where you have 14,000 people admiring Ted and his wife and the life that they imagine that they lead. So this is what I saw in Mark's situation, that he was made into a spectacle of the perfect Christian, the perfect Christian young man. And so many people were attracted to his aura. And then likewise, you know, he was involved in that. He could feel the attraction of other people, and it's a powerful thing to feel that people are really looking up to you and admiring you and feeling how you, you know, have so much influence on their lives, and you're really set up as an ideal. But it made it very difficult for Mark to then function as just an ordinary person.
Now, you point out in your chapter on Mark in See Me Naked that this can lead to a yearning for the divine. If done well, an erotic element enters into this worshipful time in young life that goes unrecognized but allows people to feel powerfully connected to something larger than themselves, and they begin to yearn for each other, yes, but also to make a connection they can't quite name. You suggest some of them begin to yearn for God.
Absolutely.
So and is this a good thing?
It could. I mean, it absolutely can be. And I certainly wasn't. And I tried carefully, as I told these stories, not to separate things too much into is it a good or a bad thing. I wanted to get beyond my own kind of snarky response to a lot of American Christianity and just say, wow, what is happening here? And if you've ever gone to a college campus of a Christian college where there's a real powerful kind of contemporary worship service or something, you see people caught up in something that looks a lot like ecstasy or kind of an erotic relationship. And I wanted to take that seriously and say Eros is this, you know, wonderful connectivity. It's a wonderful way of connecting people to each other and to the world and to God. And I wanted to take that very seriously and suggest that it can be a very powerful and beneficial thing if people are taken up out of their own tiny little circles and into something bigger and grander themselves, then I think the problem becomes when they project onto other people an ideal that, that other people just can't live with or through.
Now, you say in your in the beginning of your book that these characters, you've changed some of the circumstances. Of course, you've changed their names. And so I don't even know this is about Young Life exactly. It could equally be about Campus Crusade for Christ or InterVarsity Christian Fellowship or Youth for Christ or Campus Life or any of a number of parachurch evangelical organizations. But it could also be about very liberal, progressive Unitarian congregations mm-hmm. who also tend to choose leaders who are physically attractive and charismatic.
And I think that's something that I also, I didn't want to get drawn too much into a debate about whether this is just about evangelical Christianity or
sure.
whether mainline Protestants are also implicated, because I think that is really about a strain of American Protestant Christianity that could be talked about broadly. And so you're absolutely right. It's sort of about that projection of an ideal onto a person, onto a human being, that takes the place of community or vulnerability or connection of another kind.
What is your own religious background?
My father's a Presbyterian minister, and I spent most of my young, early years in the Presbyterian church, and then my teen years were spent in a North American Baptist church in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And then
That was your choice?
That was my choice, yep.
Uh-huh.
And then I went to St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. So then I got introduced to Lutheranism, and I started attending the chapel there at St. Olaf, and I was also a Quaker, or attended a Quaker service for a lot of those years. And eventually, working my way through the entire spectrum of American Protestantism, I am now an Episcopalian.
When you were at St. Olaf, how much did music affect your spirituality?
Oh, a lot.
That college is so well known for its wonderful music.
Absolutely. That was such a breakthrough for me to be a part of settings where sensual and sensory input was so important. The singing, the chapel at St. Olaf was so beautiful in terms of incorporating lots of elements of, there was some dancing in the aisles, there was a lot of just really corporate worship that was really beautiful to me and important as I kind of made this long trek through Protestantism.
Now, you mentioned, I think this may have been on a blog I read rather than in this book, See Me Naked, but you mentioned that you married at a relatively young age these days, at 24. You say that you and your husband, Peter, and I quote, quietly decided not to be objects to one another. And you mentioned that he did not buy you an engagement ring, you did not wear white. I think this was in a blog where you were writing about commodity dating, where people see each other as sort of trophies or things. And I thought that was interestingly related to your mm-hmm. book, See Me Naked. Several of the characters in there where they saw themselves or the person who was their desired partner as only an object. You mentioned that Reinhold Niebuhr, the great theologian, once said that pride is a sin, of course, and has been seen as a failing in the history of Christianity a great deal, but you say he points out that self-abnegation is also a sin. Talk a little bit about that.
That was in the context of a story that a woman told me about really living her whole life to try to be as pure as possible, which we often think of as a really good pursuit, that a person can achieve great heights in purity or transcendence. And she was telling me the story of trying to live that. And the interesting aspect to me was that she was really, really good at it. So she was taught in her church that a pure life is a good life. And so she went about living as pure a life as possible.
And the way pure being sexually chaste.
Sexually pure. And what she took that to mean is that she would find a way to eradicate all her desires. And so she would, anytime a desire, whether it be for food or for sex or for touch, came up, she would find a way to repress or remove that desire. And, of course, this did not lead in a very, very good direction. She was eventually diagnosed with anorexia and with another lesser well-known disorder called pelvic floor disorder, which is when the body kind of tightens up to the degree that it becomes impenetrable. And she really had to think her way out of this puzzle, which was that she had believed that she was doing good. She was doing everything right. She was behaving in a way that, that her religion and her spirituality called good and even perfect. And in doing that, she was learning to deny herself. But the problem was that she became so good at it that she stopped eating. She had worked herself into a kind of hard perfection that had to be broken down. And that's where Niebuhr became so important to her, because she realized that she had been guilty not of the sin of pride, but of the opposite sin, of giving herself entirely away. And she had to find a way to retrieve herself. And she started with desires, with really simple desires, like the desire for food. She had to teach herself to eat again, and it was a very difficult process.
I remember the theologian Peggy Way talking about that in terms of, yes, thinking too much of yourself is wrong, but so is thinking too little of yourself.
Mm-hmm. And she'd spent so many years trying to eradicate herself, which is what, you know, her favorite word was transcendence. So she wanted to transcend the body, the life of the body, and she wasn't able to do that without dying. And I think that's a really important lesson. You know, this world was an evil place, and she wanted to make sure that she got beyond it. But in the end, she had to learn how to live in it and with it in a deeper partnership.
Now, Amy Frickholm, you yourself have sort of had issues with food. If I've read correctly, you mentioned going on a diet when you were in fifth grade.
Yeah.
And you got down to, what, 85 pounds?
When I was in high school, yeah.
High school. So was that anorexia?
You know, I never would have called it that.
Uh-huh.
And I never went formally into recovery. I think it's an oddly common story for girls in our society that are trying to make their way, you know, in the world. And I think in my case, it was an attempt to learn. I was trying to learn to control my desires, to learn to control food, and that's how I thought best to learn it. But yes, I think it was very dangerous, really, but very common.
And now you write about food in a very loving and exciting way. Many of your blogs are about food. You had an article in a book by an author I interviewed a year or two ago from Washington State. I forget her three names.
Leslie Leland Fields.
Oh, yes, that's
yep.
Right. I remember you had an essay there. But you obviously enjoy food now.
Oh, yeah, I'm kind of obsessed, yeah.
How have you come to balance that appropriate desire?
Well, I'm not sure anybody would call it balanced in my life, but I would say that I really, and I hope this isn't exaggerating to a degree that people won't be able to recognize, you know, this impulse, but I really had to learn to taste again. I really got to young adulthood without an ability to taste. Because I had so repressed tasting, and I felt that, you know, food was really kind of dangerous, because once you had one cookie, you would for sure want the whole, you know, the whole batch. And so I really had to teach myself how to taste, and I'm not sure how I did that beyond just some concentrated effort over time of, okay, sit down, take a deep breath, see if you can actually be present to food. I think traveling helped a great deal.
Sounds very Buddhist.
As I went out, that's right, to be present, you know, to the thing that's in front of you. And I think traveling helped a lot, because as I left the country and watched other people's food ways and food cultures, I became so fascinated by how people put together their relationship between, you know, their basic need to eat and then this the world of abundance that's around them. And I just really got fascinated by that. And so I can say that watching other cultures gave me some perspective on my own.
And since we're talking today on Keeping the Faith about sexuality and spirituality, when you learned to taste again, at the same time, were you learning to enjoy touch?
Again, I think it was a very similar process for me where I really didn't know how to feel touch. Touch was so dangerous in my environment. The way that I perceived it was so dangerous that I had to, the best thing I knew how to do was to repress the feeling so that I wouldn't feel too much. The danger of feeling too much was really present to me. And I really think this has a lot to do with my religious environment where I had some rules that I was trying to live up to, and touch was very dangerous, and passion, desire were all scary. And so I had to practice feeling touch. And it was definitely a process of long practice. And I'm not sure, again, I don't know what it's like to be in other people's experiences, so I'm not sure if other people have this need to be so conscious in their return to sensation. But I really struggled with tasting, feeling, touching, being a part of the world, the spiritual or the sensual world was always a struggle for me.
I can remember as a young adult, I suppose I might have been college age, hearing for the first time from an evangelical Christian writer that this was a man who said, masturbation is God's gift to teenagers. Were you taught that masturbation was somehow wrong?
Gosh, what was I taught? You know, it was very confusing. I don't think I ever got really clear teaching about it. But I was definitely taught that it was a complicated and probably not so great aspect of being human. That sometimes it was necessary because, you know, we're human and we're weak, but if we were strong, we wouldn't need such things. So no, I never got that message that it was a gift.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith with Amy Frykholm, Frykholm, author of Stories of Sexual Exile in American Christianity. The title is See Me Naked, published just this last month by Beacon Press. Let me give the phone numbers again. We're eager to have listeners. Give us a call. Anywhere the program is heard, if it's a long-distance call to Urbana, Illinois, punch in 1-800-222-9455. If you are in the Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, listening area 217-333-9455. That'll put you in touch with our guest, Amy Frykholm. And let me mention again where more information, about her can be found. She has a website, amyfrykholm.com. Very good website. Mentions all three of her books. I've only read her latest one, but after reading this, I have already ordered the first two. So I'm very, very pleased to be talking with her on the air today. She's a regular writer for The Christian Century. What is your exact title?
It's Associate Editor.
Associate Editor. And you write fairly regularly. I saw, four or five articles of yours going back several years?
I do write about six articles a year.
Six a year. And I mentioned the most recent one is in the November 29th issue. You can also subscribe to the print edition of Christian Century, or you can get it online, or you can do both. There's several ways to read writings by Amy Frykholm. In addition, she has blogs. And are those blogs free, or does one have to subscribe?
No, they're all free.
They're all free. Okay.
Even the Christian Century's blog is free as well.
Very good. I knew I found it, but I couldn't remember how I did it. I'm considerably older than you, and some of these modern technological things are still a mystery to me.
I hear you.
Let's talk a little bit about one of the most interesting characters in your book, and it involves prostitution. Tell us how you got into that story, that and how you met that character.
That was such an important piece of this for me, and it happened much later after I'd been interviewing and talking to people for a long time. But I went as part of a Christian Century story, to Nashville, Tennessee, to talk to women who are part of a recovery program called Magdalene, which is in Nashville, Tennessee, and it's a beautiful program where women who are recovering from prostitution and drug addiction come and they get 2 years of housing, food, medical care, absolutely psychological care, everything that they could possibly need are paid for. Their Diet Cokes are paid for, everything, nail polish. They come and they spend 2 years in this housing trying to recover from prostitution, which is a very interesting dilemma. I'd never really thought about, you know, I had this idea, of course, anybody who had an economic way out of prostitution would take it. But because it involves sexuality, it's something much more intimately related to the person than...
Very complicated.
Very complicated, because your sense of self is at stake in this.
You are desired. You are
absolutely
attractive. Yeah.
And if you're not, that's also, you know, at stake. And what's happening in prostitution is about who you are as a person. And I think it's much more painful to let that go than it looks like on the surface. And so I went to spend some days with the women who were recovering from this program. There's a wonderful NPR series on this program. So just a plug for NPR. You could Google NPR and Magdalene and see a wonderful program, a series on this house that I visited. But it gave me the chance to sit down with women who were in recovery from prostitution and spend time talking with them and hearing their stories. And there was one woman in particular, she and I just really hit it off and found it easy to talk to one another. And so we spent a lot of time sitting in the courtyard in the sunshine and just talking about our lives and stories and histories. And so she allowed me to draw that story into this book, which I thought was very brave of her and very generous. And I worried about that story more than any of the others that I told, just because I was so far outside my own knowledge and my own understanding, and I wanted to be as careful and as loving and as compassionate as I could to her story, and then be as true to it too as I could.
You say it's outside your experience, but one of the reviews of your book that I encountered mentioned that really you're being both a journalist and a sociologist as you do these interviews, and I think that really shows up in what in these fascinating 9 stories that you tell. Before we leave, just your last comment, I do want to spell for listeners how to look up Magdalene. It's spelled Magdalene. And so if you go to Corporation for Public Broadcasting, NPR, you can find the story that Amy Frickholm was just referring to. When you were talking to... None of these stories are composites, so they really are one person. Mm-hmm. But you did interview, as you mentioned, several others. You did interview other prostitutes who were in this program in addition to the one you describe in the book?
Yes, yep.
Okay.
And also, it was, you know, interestingly, I had to try to grasp her religious milieu, because it was very important that I now tell not only the story of her sexuality, but also the story of her religious milieu. And that maybe was one of the most difficult aspects of this, because I didn't want to get it wrong, and I still may have gotten it wrong, but I wanted to be sure that I understood religiously she was taught in such a way that she felt that the path that she had already taken had damned her, and so there was no point in turning around, that she was already so far gone that there was no point in finding another way of life. And so when she was in recovery from prostitution, she really also had to recover a new spirituality, a new understanding of God, a new way to understand her relation with God. And that was all an important part of the story.
Now, you have 3 sections in your book, and this section comes under, well, I'll let you talk about it. How did you decide how to categorize these?
That was also a real challenge, to figure out what to do once you have these stories and you know the body of material you're working with. What, you know, how do you put them together? And I ended up with a kind of a theological, which is odd for me because journalist sociologist fits me much better than theologian, but I think of it still as a kind of theological structure. So I start with stories that I call wilderness stories, and I think that a lot of people in our culture find spirituality or find sexuality a real wilderness. They don't know how to make themselves into proper sexual beings, or however that would work. They don't know how to do it. And so they end up in the wilderness. And I think in the Christian tradition, in the Jewish tradition as well, we have this idea that the wilderness is a scary and dangerous place, but it's also a place where people encounter God. And so I wanted to give these wilderness stories the sense that it wasn't like people are abandoned in their misery in the wilderness. They often are finding really true, deep, and meaningful paths in the wilderness. And so I tell three stories about that. And then the second section is what I call incarnation stories. And those are stories like the woman who learned to eat again. That is an incarnation story. She learned to accept and find a life in the body. And then the third stories I call resurrection stories, which are stories about the really great damage that sexuality can do and spirituality can do as well, and then how people found their way back to life.
And so that's resurrection.
And that's resurrection. Right. And the other piece that makes it resurrection is that people made this new life out of their wounds. They didn't deny their pasts or put it all away. They really constructed their new lives based on the pain that they had experienced.
In the middle section of your book, you refer to a contemporary poet, Christian Wiman, who, incidentally, I have invited to be on the show, but because of his very serious illness with cancer, he's not been able to do yet. I hope sometime to be able to talk with him. But you mentioned one of his poems from his most recent book of poetry called Every Riven Thing. And I'd like to read that particular poem you refer to at this point. We have about 15 minutes left of our time together, and I thought this would get us into some interesting issues of spirituality and sexuality. This is called From a Window. It's a poem by Christian Wiman, W-I-M-A-N. He's the current editor of Poetry Magazine in Chicago. This is from his most recent book, Every Riven Thing, published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. Christian Wiman writes, From a Window. Incurable and unbelieving in any truth but the truth of grieving, I saw a tree inside a tree rise kaleidoscopically, as if the leaves had livelier ghosts. I pressed my face as close to the pain as I could get to watch that fitful, fluent spirit that seemed a single being, undefined or countless beings of one mind, haul its strange cohesion beyond the limits of my vision over the house heavenwards. Of course I knew those leaves were birds. Of course that old tree stood exactly as it had and would, but why should it seem fuller now? And though a man's mind might endow even a tree with some excess of life to which a man seems witness, that life is not the life of men. And that is where the joy came in. A poem by Christian Wiman in his recently published book of poetry, Every Riven Thing. The poem is called From a Window, from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. What grabbed you about that poem?
I think it was the sense. I love Christian Wiman's poetry because I think the very idea of every riven thing, everything that is a part of this world, that's created in this world, is also a means toward the eternal or the divine or the holy. And like I have been trying to do, I think Wiman, more beautifully than I, is able to inhabit that in-between space, that space between heaven and earth. And this poem is about finding that life in a tree, a dead tree, with some birds in it, and then watching those birds take life and realizing that there was a life beyond the ordinary that he could also see in the tree. So it was that mix of the heavenly and the earthly that I thought was so powerful.
And you include this in your section of your book, See Me Naked, in the section on incarnation, enfleshment. Some of the people you describe in that section really seem, oh goodness, so wounded. And yet you show that, I mean, they're not, that the image of resurrection is a possibility. You lead to that somehow without making it sappy.
I think, you know, in our, again, in our culture, we think of sexual wounds as being maybe so permanent. They do so much damage that there's no means of real recovery. We have that idea. And I think that we have to get past that idea, and we have to see ourselves as always being in relationship, a new creation, always being remade and reborn and challenged in new ways, growing in new ways. And even though certainly sexual wounds are deep and painful and very difficult, they aren't the end of any of our stories.
We have a caller waiting on line number one. Let me give the numbers for other callers who might like to join us. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, elsewhere 1-800-222-9455. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Amy Frickholm. Go ahead.
Hi, Amy. First of all, I realize, and you probably talk about this, the importance of being cherished, which I think is part of sexuality. And, of course, falls into the belief of Christianity and of Jesus or many other faiths. I'm curious as to what you might have said about homosexual relationships, where you've got people who do care about each other and part of caring is touching. And the other question is, what age range did you cover in your book?
Oh, that's right. Great questions. I'll start with the first question, and remind me if I don't get to the second. But the first question about homosexuality, I tell two stories, of one of a woman and one of a man, and each one is very different. But I don't necessarily see, of course, in our society, a homosexual story is more difficult for homosexual people to tell. But in a lot of ways, they're also very similar. They often tried to live a certain way and found that that was a failure and had to find a different route. So one of my stories is about a man named Paul who was all his life, from the time that he was tiny, he wanted to be a Lutheran minister. He knew that that was his calling and his life. And that led him for about 3 decades of his life to not even be able to acknowledge that he was homosexual. He didn't even know until he was in his late 20s and in seminary to become a Lutheran pastor. And so it's a story really of him learning to eventually root his spirituality in his sexuality and in his body and recover a form of the Christian faith for himself that that really is about learning to be fully who he was. And so he tells that story, you know, really in lots of nuance and lots of detail. And to me, it's a really precious story because he is saying something that I deeply recognize myself, which is that it's very easy to keep your sexuality in one place and your spirituality in the other place. And it's much more difficult, especially in Christianity, to learn to tell those two stories together. So I think it's a really beautiful example of that.
And because of discrimination against gays and lesbians so prevalent in our society and elsewhere, it can be very difficult to even be willing to acknowledge your own orientation.
That's right. Absolutely. For him, and he thought that in order to acknowledge his orientation, he had to leave. He had to leave the church. There was no choice for him inside the church. There was no room for him there. But that isn't the end of the story. He learned that there was a place, and that he could make a place for himself. And that's not everybody's story, for sure. But for him, that was a really important part, that he could live his vocation as a Lutheran minister and live his vocation as a cherished gay man. He was terrified that he was going to have to live his life never being fully humanly loved. And that was a very, very frightening prospect for him.
And but your second story about the lesbian relationship, you might mention a few words about that, and then we'll get to the age range of your story.
Yes, that's right. So Paul is a man who's now in his mid-50s, and I think the oldest person I interviewed is probably now in their 60s, and then the youngest person is probably just 20. I'm trying to think because, you know, this book was in process for so long that some of these stories, people grew up, you know. But I think that the youngest person's now 24. So the story she was telling me was when she was quite young. And the woman who is a bisexual woman told me her story when she was very, very young. So she was a young woman at a Christian college, and she was really struggling with this bisexual identity, which really wasn't acceptable in her
subculture.
In her subculture, not remotely. And it took her a very long time to find language, to find acceptance for it, to really accept that God might be willing to love her through this, through the love of another woman, that might be God willing to love. So that seems to often be a struggle for people to understand that their sexuality might be a way that God is striving to love them.
Amy, since there was a question about age, you've mentioned in your blog your own age currently. May I say it on the air?
Yeah,
or would
sure.
You rather?
No, it's fine.
Okay, I believe you're approaching 40?
Yeah, like within a few days.
And is that a struggle for you?
Yeah, it definitely is. I don't know.
You've been young for so long.
I know. I don't know anything else, and I'm definitely not as young as I once was.
We have another caller waiting again on line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Amy Frickholm, author of See Me Naked.
Hello. I've been thinking about when I was teaching Chaucer, the Canterbury Tales, and I was just stunned at the sort of split in Christianity that the character showed. You know, marriage was sort of considered second best. Celibacy was really best. It was quite interesting.
Yeah.
That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. And that fits in with several chapters in your book where you talk about
Christianity really is an interesting puzzle in terms of its relationship between the relationship to sexuality, going back, as this caller points out, a long way.
And one of the things that you talk about is someone who was influenced by True Love Waits. Tell us about that.
So True Love Waits is one of several purity movements in American culture. So in a response, I think, to hypersexualization of teenagers in American culture and lots of media, we could point to all kinds of examples of that. In the late, I guess the mid-1990s, several groups started these purity or chastity movements where teenagers would commit to living without sex until they got married. And they would sign commitments and they would get rings. And I interviewed a lot of subjects, a lot of people who were a part of these movements with, you know, very different results, lots of variety in those movements. But one of the core findings of my research and of the book is, I think, that often the result of a kind of commitment like that is an alienation from oneself, from one's desires, from one's being, and a need then later to recover the ability to be, you know, be in the world as I've described for myself. So the one of the women was the anorexic woman who was very involved in True Love Waits. Mark also was influenced strongly by that culture. And there are certainly good things about it, and there are certainly alternatives. There's a wonderful book right now called Making Chastity Sexy by Christine Gardner, who's a professor at Wheaton. And she really looks in depth at these movements, and I think it's an excellent treatment of the subject and deeper and more nuanced than my treatment of it. But in general, my finding is that that there are hidden costs to signing an abstinence pledge.
We're down to our last couple minutes, Amy Frickholm. Your last section of your book talks about sort of a different way to think about sexual ethics within a religious framework. What are some of your thoughts?
Well, I was very cautious about doing this because I never wanted my book to be the only kind of books I'd ever read about religion and sexuality were about kind of how to do it right, the right way to live. We just get the standards right and we all live that way, then we'll be fine. And I really didn't want to write that book, so I was very tentative. You asked if I was pushed to tell personal stories, but more than anything, I was pushed to say something about an alternative, what I call an alternative sexual ethic. It was very hard for me to do because I didn't want to give people a prescription. I felt like so much of our writing and thinking and experience of religion and sexuality is prescriptive. And sure, it'd be great if, you know, the rules just worked and we could apply them and we all lived perfect lives, but that wasn't the reality of the people I interviewed or of my own reality. So I wanted to offer people some alternative, but it was difficult to do so. So I started with some principles, I call them, I guess, and one of them is a sense of wonder, of awe at the mystery of our existence and of the difficulty of living fully as our dual nature, being, you know, both human and also somehow souled beings, something like that. So I wanted, I thought that a sense of wonder was important because it was important to think maybe you don't have all the answers. Maybe you didn't just screw everything up, but you were given the answers early. Maybe you could, you know, live simply with a sense of wonder. I also thought that pleasure was a more important marker of our spirituality than we give it credit for. I think we often shove pleasure to the corner, thinking we're being selfish or hedonistic. We have a terrible fear of being hedonistic, of giving in to our pleasures. But I think careful attention to true pleasure can also be a way of really understanding what God is up to, of being more intimately related to the divine through our senses. And I thought that discernment then becomes really important because if somebody can't just hand you a package with the rules and you just follow them, then you need to be in a deeper relationship with your own understanding, and I call that discernment.
We'll need to stop there. We are out of time with our guest today, Amy Frickholm. I want to thank her very much, as well as our callers
for
talking with us today. Her book is, most recent book, See Me Naked, Stories of Sexual Exile in American Christianity, published by Beacon Press. Amy Frickholm, her name is spelled F-R-Y-K-H-O-L-M. She has a good website. You can go to find more information about her other writings, amyfrickholm.com. She is also a associate editor of the Christian Century magazine, published in Chicago, and a regular contributor to that. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
When you donate appreciated stock you've held for more than a year, instead of selling it, you can save tax two ways. First, you avoid capital gains tax on the increase in value of your stock. Second, you receive a deduction for the full fair market value of the stock on the date you make the gift. I'm Donda Beard, and you can call me at WILL for more information about giving stock. Thanks for your support.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM.